Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney. I'm chair of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program entitled From Climate Reality to Project Drawdown. Is this happening to us or for us? We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events held here at the club and to register for our upcoming events. We have several good ones this month. On the 23rd of October, there's In Search of a Healthy Workplace with Google Food Director Michael Backer. That should be an unusual opportunity to hear from inside Google Food. On October 24th, Conscious Business, How Leaders Are Embedding Sustainability Principles in Their Organizations. We'll be doing that one in partnership with Presidio. And then in November, we're pleased to have Jed Emerson and Donna Morton on November 27th for the Transformation and Purpose of Capital. So please join us for some of those. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers, Amanda Joy Ravenhill and Malcolm Walter. Amanda Ravenhill is the executive director at the Buckminster Fuller Institute, where she leads efforts on multiple fronts to further solutions to address climate change. While teaching principles of sustainable management at Presidio, Amanda met Paul Hawken. It was there that the idea for work on Project Drawdown began. The culmination of the research from Amanda, Paul, and numerous 2009 Presidio students led to the birth of the New York Times bestseller Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. It was published in 2017. Malcolm Walter's career spans 40 years and includes serving as the COO and CFO for several private and public organizations. In 2016, Malcolm retired after a 17-year career as COO of Bentley Systems, a global software company whose mission is sustaining infrastructure. He serves as treasurer on the board of directors at Presidio Graduate School and vice chair of the board for Water for People. With 13 grandchildren, Malcolm's focus is leaving a legacy not just of hope, but of solutions. Here to have a stimulating dialogue, an image-rich presentation, we welcome our speakers.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth, for that kind introduction, and thanks to all of you for being here tonight. I can tell you that Amanda and I are thrilled to have this opportunity to speak at the Commonwealth Club. And as Elizabeth pointed out, we've titled this presentation From Climate Reality to Project Drawdown, Is This Happening to Us or for Us? So implicit in that question is whether climate change, we are the victims of that, or is global warming the biggest and best opportunity that mankind has ever been faced with? So do you feel depressed and hopeless, or do you feel optimistic and like we can do this? And that's really the question here. And we would like to believe that when you leave here, you'll leave here feeling optimistic. So this picture here is taken by NASA in the Apollo 17 mission in 1972. It's the first picture of the Earth fully illuminated that anyone has ever seen. And it's often credited as the start of the modern environmental movement because for the first time, we're able to see that this is a single planet for all 7.5 billion people. We share this. It's a common home. It's called Earth, and we better take care of it. I've organized my presentation to answer three questions related to global warming and climate change. Must we change? Can we change and will we change? Now, the environmental movement has spent most of its energy on must we change, and it's very depressing. And I'm going to share those depressing stats with you, and we'll get depressed together. But importantly, the questions 2 and 3 is where it really needs to happen. And the answers to both those questions are yes and yes. So that's sort of a spoiler alert as we move through here. So must we change? Here's another picture from NASA. This is the sun rising over the surface of the Earth. And what you see there illuminated is our atmosphere. Now, the Earth's atmosphere, the first layer, is called the troposphere. And it has 75% of the total mass of our atmosphere. It's about 6 miles deep. The next layer is the stratosphere. That has another 20% of the total volume of our atmosphere. And it's about 20 miles deep. So together, if you were driving at highway speed straight up, you would go through our atmosphere and you would be in space in 30 minutes. That's how thin our atmosphere is. So how does the Earth get warm? Solar radiation coming from the sun, traveling 93 million miles, hits the Earth. It penetrates the atmosphere, and that begins to warm the Earth. Now, some of that energy gets reflected back into space. It's bouncing off of water, off of ice sheets, off of snow, and goes back into space. And some of those reflected rays get captured in the atmosphere and bounce back and further warm the Earth. Now, we've been dumping 110 million tons of man-made greenhouse gases into our atmosphere every single day. And that has had the impact of thickening our atmosphere so that more of those reflected rays are staying inside our atmosphere and further warming the Earth. Now, greenhouse gases have many sources. Right, so we've got fertilization, forest burning, landfills, fossil fuels, agricultural, but the overwhelming source of CO2 has been the burning of fossil fuels. And in this chart, we see it, the graph of this, and after World War II, things really began to take off. If there's any good news on this chart, it's in the upper right-hand corner there where you can see that it's flattened out after many years of going up steeply. So just how warm has the planet gotten? If we use the 30-year period roughly following World War II as our baseline, we have in the middle there in white the average days. To the left-hand side in blue, we have the cooler days, and on the right-hand side in red, the warmer days. So move that forward, and it's basically a bell curve, right? You go forward 10 years, and we start to shift out to the right, and we see the emergence here of some extremely hot days. 10 more years, and we're shifting further to the right. The most recent 10 years measured here, we've gone yet further to the right, such that now the extremely hot days are roughly equal to what used to be average and cool. And in fact, about 15% of the days are now extremely hot when before, it was only 0.1% of our experience. 17 of the 18 hottest days on record have occurred since 2001, with the last 4 years being the hottest ever. And most of that gets trapped in our oceans. So 93% of that heat goes into our oceans. Of course, if you look at a globe, we're mostly made of water, so that's where it goes. And that has the impact of also warming our ocean temperatures. So it's been on kind of a linear ride here, with 2017 recording the highest temperatures ever in our oceans. Now, when the oceans get warmer, that makes for more frequent and more powerful storms. So in 2015, for the first time ever, there were 3 Category 4 hurricanes occurring at the same time here in the Pacific Ocean. Then we had Hurricane Harvey about a year ago. It intensified from a tropical depression to a Category 4 storm in just 2 days. That's a record. And if we track Harvey traveling across the Gulf of Mexico, it was tracking over water that was 7 degrees warmer than normal, 200 meters deep. So it intensified. It pulled a lot of more water out of the ocean. And then it dumped 33 trillion gallons on Houston, which is equivalent to Niagara Falls flowing for about a year and a half on your city. And so we end up with the pictures, right? The nursing home that's flooded downtown and a suburb here. And this isn't the first time this has happened to Houston. Houston's had seven major flood events in the two-year period ending with Harvey. Three of those were 1 in 500-year events, and two 1 in 1,000-year events. So I think we have a calibration problem. If we go back to Hurricane Sandy in 2012, that hit the eastern seaboard, made landfall at Atlantic City, then traveled up to Manhattan. And I'm now going to show you a clip from Gore's first movie, Inconvenient Truth, in which he spoke about the impact of sea level rise and how it might impact Manhattan.
This is what would happen to Manhattan. They can measure this precisely, just as the scientists could predict precisely how much water would breach the levees in New Orleans. The area where the World Trade Center Memorial is to be located would be underwater.
The Hudson River, downtown Manhattan, was literally pouring into the Ground Zero site.
So exactly what was modeled and predicted is what happened when Hurricane Sandy hit. Just last year, three hurricanes at one time again. So we have Katia hitting Mexico. We have Irma in the middle that came across Cuba and then hit the Florida Keys. And then Jose, which thankfully went up the eastern seaboard and did not make landfall. Looking at Irma, it remained a Category 5 hurricane for three straight days. That's a new global record. And when it hit the Keys in Florida, FEMA estimates that 35 or 25% of the homes were destroyed and 65 are significantly damaged. Just a couple of weeks later, we have Hurricane Maria, a Category 5 hurricane that hit Puerto Rico, which you see down in the lower right-hand part of your screen. We've seen those pictures of Puerto Rico, and today Puerto Rico is still very challenged. Just last month, Hurricane Florence comes in and hits the Carolinas, dropping tons of rain. There's been at least 53 deaths and $45 billion of damage estimated. And then just last week, Hurricane Michael hitting the Florida panhandle. Here is Mexico City, Florida. When it made landfall, it was a Category 4 hurricane. It's the third most intense hurricane that ever hit the U.S. according to pressure. And it's the fourth strongest in terms of wind speed. The peak wind speed was 155 miles per hour. This scientist at Penn State said that unrestrained climate change means we're likely to see many more Harveys in our future. And of course, that's exactly what's been happening this year. There have been 16 one in 1,000-year downpour events in the U.S. since May of 2010. And of course, hotter temperatures also means we have more fires. And you know, all you have to do is live in California to know this is true. So we have this Latuna Canyon fire, which was about a year ago. And it was the largest fire in L.A.'s history. Then we had the Napa fire happening a month later, along with the one in Sonoma, with Santa Rosa having over 3,000 homes destroyed. Then just 2 months after that, we have the fire in Ventura, which is now the largest fire in L.A. history. And just this summer, the Carr fire in Redding, followed by the Mendocino Complex fire. 459,000 acres burned. That is now the largest fire in California history. How many 200,000-plus acre fires has California had? Well, in the 114-year period ending in 2003, there's one. In the 15 years since 2003, we've had seven. So things have definitely changed. In 2017, the overall losses from weather-related disasters totaled $320 billion. So this is also getting expensive. And you can't talk about climate change without talking about glaciers. So here's a picture of a glacier in Greenland, 1935. Here's that same glacier today. And the amount of declining ice mass in Greenland over the last 10 years has been dramatic. That leads to sea level rise. So that we actually have this picture, this video from Miami Beach in what's called a sunny, wet day. Sunny because it's not raining. Wet because the ocean is on the streets of Miami. In Miami now, there are no wake zones in the streets. That's not for boats, that's for cars. The U.S. Department of Defense came out and said that climate change will likely lead to food and water shortages, pandemic disease, and disputes over refugees. It turns out that that extra heat that's pulling all that water out of our oceans is also taking whatever moisture is in the land and drying out the land, creating drought conditions. So we have this Syrian farmer who says, I had 400 acres of wheat, and now it's all desert. In fact, there was a four-year drought in Syria in which 60% of their fertile land was turned to desert. That drove 1.5 million people into Syria's already overcrowded cities. Of course, that has led to the wars that we have there, the humanitarian crisis that is unprecedented, and refugees throughout all of Europe and other parts of the world. If that's not enough, climate change is also a medical emergency, according to the Lancet Commission. And these medical associations in the U.S. agree the health impact of climate change demand immediate action. And then finally, we're now at risk of losing up to 50% of all land-based species in this century. This would be the largest mass extinction of life form on this planet since the dinosaurs. So must we change? This can't go on, right? We got to stop this. So we have to change, no question. Let's get to the next question. Can we change? And the good news here is that we have the solutions. Let's start with wind. So the projections in 2000 were that wind capacity would grow by 30 gigawatts by 2010. The reality is that by 2017, we've exceeded that by 18 times. So if we look at the installed wind capacity, things really began to take off at the beginning of this century. And of course, then the cost of wind has dramatically come down over that period from over 200 euros per megawatt hour to now less than 50 euros. And in terms of it being a renewable resource, we get enough wind globally to supply our world's electric requirements 40 times over. In November 2017, Mexico received bids for wind electricity at $1.77 per kilowatt hour. That's a new world record. And the U.S. now has 84 gigawatts of wind installed, which can power 25 million homes. In Texas, they have so much wind that some utilities are offering free electricity at night. All right, let's turn to solar. The projection in 2002 is that the solar energy market would grow by 1 gigawatt per year by 2010. The reality is that that was exceeded by 17 times, and in 2017, that's been exceeded 98 times. So if we look at the installed, yeah, this is awesome, totally awesome. Here's the installed capacity of solar. Things took off in 2010, just have been on a rocket ship. The cost then has dropped dramatically from $79 per watt to now 32 cents. And in terms of it being a renewable resource, there's enough solar energy that gets to Earth every hour to power all the requirements of the world for an entire year. Imminently renewable. You can't talk about renewables without talking about batteries, right? So here's the storage capacity that has already been installed. And here is the projections. And you'll see that 2018 is down there somewhere in the first third. So the projections are to, this is really about to take off in terms of storage. And here's what a utility scale battery looks like. This is the world's largest lithium ion battery built by Tesla in southern Australia. In January of this year, Xcel Energy announced a bid to purchase solar electricity plus storage at 3.6 cents per kilowatt hour. That's the lowest price ever in the U.S. They also announced a bid for wind plus storage at 2.1 cents per kilowatt hour. And here are the auto manufacturers that have announced electric vehicles. They either have one in production or in design. It's essentially every automobile manufacturer in the world. Beijing has announced that they're going to remove all the gas-powered taxis and replace them with electric. India is going a step further and saying, we're eliminating all fossil fuel cars in India and replacing those with electric. In fact, here are the countries that have already stated a fossil fuel vehicle phase-out. Norway, Netherlands, India, China, Scotland, France, Britain, Germany. This is fantastic news. General Motors says they believe the future is all electric. Volvo has already come out and said by next year, all their models will either be electric or they'll be hybrid. And by 2025, it's estimated that half of the buses in the world will be electric buses. This is all fantastic news. Deutsche Bank said that we believe the trend is clear. Grid parity without subsidies is already here. Increasing parity will occur as solar penetration rates are set to ramp worldwide. So let's take a look at the installed capacity of energy in 2009. It's about equal mix between fossil fuels and renewables. 4 years later, renewables is more than 2x. That continued the following year and continued the following year. In 2016, renewables represented better than 2/3 of the installed capacity of energy, with natural gas being another quarter and a tiny, tiny sliver there of coal. In the U.S., there are twice as many jobs in solar as there is in coal mining. If we look at coal across the country, these are the plants that have been proposed and defeated. Here are the existing plants that have been retired, and here are the ones where their retirement has been announced. Coal has been canceled. Right? Right? The way I like to say is breaking news, coal is dead. You won't see another coal plant built in the U.S. It's over. In May 2017, India received bids for solar power at 2.44 rupees per kilowatt. This is 24% lower than a coal plant. So it's dead in India, too. Why would you ever build a coal plant? And Morgan Stanley says that we project by 2020, which is only a year and a half away, renewables will be the cheapest form of new power generation across the globe, everywhere, right? So let's be honest. Coal is dead, dead, dead. So can we change? Yes, absolutely. Bigger question is, will we change? Yes. Now, yes, thank you. We have our answer. All right, so you're aware that the world came together in Paris in 2015 to sign the Paris Agreement, virtually every nation signing up for net zero greenhouse gas emissions, which was defined as holding the increase in our global average temperatures to 2 degrees centigrade pre-industrial levels. And then this aspirational target of, let's see if we can keep it to 1.5 degrees. And when we say virtually every country, there are only two countries that didn't. One of those was Nicaragua, and the other was Syria. Now, Nicaragua boycotted the Paris Agreement because they felt the aspirational goal of 1.5 should be the commitment. So they said, we're not coming. Syria had its own problems. Well, just last year, Nicaragua signs on. A month after that, Syria signs on, leaving only the U.S. as a country that says, we're pulling out. All right, if there's any good news there, the first day that the U.S. can pull out is the day after the next presidential election. So if you need any additional encouragement to go vote, let's vote for a planet that we can all live on. What do you say, right? Just last week, the International Panel on Climate Change issued a special report. They were asked to go and look at what would happen if the temperatures increased by 1.5 degrees, because the modeling they've done in the past has been based upon this 2-degree threshold. And the news isn't very good, because they basically said all the bad things we see at 2 degrees also happens at 1.5, almost all of them. So 1.5, Nicaragua's right, basically, is what that's saying. And our temperatures have already increased by 1 degree, pre-industrial. So we have 0.5 degree left, which means, you know what, game on. We have got to get to work, right? We have got to take this serious. Let's make it happen. Now, one of the reasons that the Trump administration pointed to was, well, India and China aren't going to hold up their part of the bargain. It turns out they're on track to exceed their commitments. And this from Morgan Stanley. Notwithstanding the Trump administration, we expect the U.S. to exceed its Paris commitments as well. So how can that be? Well, it's because the innovation in global markets, rather than politics, are the primary driver for a growth in a low-carbon economy. Prices for batteries, solar panels will continue to drop, and global market share gains will continue for wind, solar, electric vehicles, and LEDs, regardless of who occupies the warehouse. This from Goldman Sachs. All right, here are the cities across the U.S. that have made commitments to 100% renewable electricity. Here are the ones that are already there. 15 states representing a third of the U.S. population have signed on to the U.S. Climate Alliance, led by Washington, New York, and our beautiful home state here of California. This is great news. And when the Trump administration said we're pulling out, there was the We Are Still In campaign that the U.S. has gotten behind. 450 cities, 15 states, over 300 colleges, over 1,700 businesses say we're still in. They've signed up to the Paris Agreement. Over 130 global companies have made a commitment to go 100% renewable. This is all fantastic news. Last year, our government produced a climate report. It was the fourth National Climate Assessment Report. The principal authors was the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, so NOAA. The Department of Energy and NASA were the principal authors, supported by all these other departments in the U.S. Here's what the report says. It's extremely likely that human activities, right, and they define extremely likely as 97% plus, it's extremely likely that human activities, especially greenhouse gases, are the dominant cause of the observed warming. So this is our government telling us that we're doing this, right? In spite of some people in the government saying that's not true. Global average sea levels are expected to continue to rise by at least several inches in the next 15 years. 1 to 4 feet by the end of the century. 8 feet can't be ruled out. Well, at 4 feet, that's a disaster. At 8 feet, it's catastrophic. Right? This just can't happen. The incidence of large forest fires in the West is projected to further increase. We have seen that played out. In 2014 and 15, emission growth rates slowed. All right, we saw that at the top of the chart. So that happened. And this is probably the most important. Choices made today will determine the magnitude of climate change risks beyond the next few decades. Right? It's the choices that we make today that really matter, right? So I'm reminded of this urban mural that I saw in Oakland. We are the ones we've been waiting for. All right, so choices made today, that's us. We can't let the next generation make these choices. This is our responsibility. It's our choices. We are the ones we've been waiting for. And so if you're feeling hopeless, that's a problem. We need to feel optimistic. We can do this. We can beat this, right? That's where we need to be. So just last month, right here in San Francisco, was the Global Climate Action Summit that Jerry Brown called, brought countries from all over the world, companies from all over the world, other organizations, and over a two-day period, it was just one commitment, one action after another to combat global warming. I was fortunate to be a delegate there, and it was two spectacular days. Our own Governor Brown presented, and he mentioned what the legislature had passed earlier in the week. California approves a goal for 100% carbon-free electricity by 2045, and everyone believes we're going to get there much earlier than that. So I'm going to mention this book, Drawdown. You're going to hear more of this from my co-presenter, Amanda. This is a fabulous book. Came out at about the same time that Gore's second movie, Inconvenient Sequel, came out. It outlines 80 solutions. All of them have been well-researched and identifies the gigatons of CO2 to be eliminated, what that would cost, and the savings or revenue potential from doing so. And in the back, all these are listed in the index. So here are the 80 solutions. Here's the gigatons to be eliminated. What's the cost of doing that? And here's the revenue. So if you sort this by revenue, the top item on there is electric vehicles at $9.7 trillion. So is there any doubt why the automobile manufacturers are building electric cars? It's a great business. Of course they're going to do that. And if you look at the total of this, it's $74 trillion. All right, so people are saying that this move to a net zero emissions is the next great industrial revolution. All right, there's money to be gone. So follow the money. That's what's going to happen. There's 74 businesses behind this. We don't need the politics. This is going to happen. So the Pachamama Alliance has a drawdown initiative where you can learn more about this. They've got a two-hour workshop and then an online course. And their next Thursday at their offices in the Presidio, they're going to be giving this the two-hour workshop. So they're hoping that as many of you are interested will come. So will we change? Yes, right? We're going to change. Absolutely. Speaking of Pachamama, I traveled with them to Ecuador a few years back to see the work they do in preserving the rainforest. And while I was there, I was introduced to this spoken word poem that I want to share with you.
It's 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the season started failing, as the mammals, reptiles, and birds were all dying. Did you fill the streets with protests when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew?
And I really think that's the big question. That's the question for all of us, because we're the ones we've been waiting for, right? What did you do once you knew? That's our question. And this is not a hypothetical question for me, because as Elizabeth pointed out, I have 13 grandkids. I've got River right in the front row here. This is Sonia. She's 5. She's going to ask me this question. Grampies, what did you do once you knew? And I need a good answer. I need a good answer for my grandkids, your grandkids, all the grandkids in the world. We all need a better answer than we have today. So what did you do once you knew? And we can't unknow what we know. All right, so we're now all in this together. What did you do? So one of the things you can do is attend this training that I went to, Climate Reality Leadership Training. This is the Al Gore training. It's 3 days. It's free. I went last year to Pittsburgh. That's me. Among 1,400 other people who were there. That's totally worth doing. Get this book, Drawdown, and read it. It's fabulous, right? It'll tell you lots of things that you can do. And as Elizabeth pointed out, my co-presenter was a major part of bringing Drawdown into the world, working with Paul while they were both teaching at a course together at Presidio Graduate School. So here's the acknowledgement page. There's Amanda right at the top. And these are all the students at Presidio that participated in that endeavor. So it's not out of line to say Drawdown was born at Presidio. And Presidio, by the way, they'll be out here in the reception area. You can learn more about the sustainability MBA and MPA that they offer. With that, I want to introduce the remarkable and amazing Amanda Ravenhill.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amanda Joy Ravenhill. I'm honored to be the executive director of the Buckminster Fuller Institute. And my mission is to ensure that our response to climate change is a positive catalyst that brings humanity back to what's once again being a beneficial species. So that's what we'll talk about this evening. So I was born in Abidjan, which is the capital of Côte d'Ivoire, also known as Ivory Coast in West Africa. Both of my parents are anthropologists, and I grew up in West Africa and the Caribbean and South America, and just saw incredible injustice and unfairness from a really young age. That really affected me very deeply, and from a young age just knew that I had to do something about it. And so I studied international development and social change in my undergrad at Clark University, and then moved back to Bolivia, where I'd spend all my high school years. And I was a executive director of a fair trade handicraft exporting program there, working with artisans, and it was just my dream job. I was having so much fun. I was making, I was kind of being the anthropologist that my parents taught me to be. And these one in a thousand year weather events kept on happening year after year. These weather events that are supposed to happen every 1,000 years. And literally the foundation of some of the homes of the women that I was working with got washed away by a landslide. And in fair trade, it's all about really a hand up instead of a handout. You're building the foundation of people's lives. And to see climate change wiping away our work so viscerally, really deeply impacted me. And so I kind of saw that climate change is this multiplier. So there's this complex, you know, equation of progress. And, you know, there's all sorts of different elements, social justice and trauma healing and ecosystem regeneration and all of these different things that we need to do. But if we don't deal with climate change, all that can wash away. And what I've discovered in the years since is that climate change can also be a multiplier in the other effect, in the other way, that if we deal with climate change well, all those other things can become easier. So we'll get into some examples of that tonight. So my other mission, which is actually the mission of the Buckminster Fuller Institute and the mission that Buckminster Fuller used for World Game, which was his really powerful world peace game strategy, is to make the world work for 100% of humanity in the shortest possible time through spontaneous cooperation without ecological offense or the disadvantage of anyone, which is almost like a riddle because there's so much in there. So I'll break it down. So making the world work is really about ensuring the health and the integrity of our spaceship Earth, as Buckminster Fuller called it. The 100% of humanity is about playing a non-zero-sum game. It's everybody or nobody. So it no longer is I can only profit at your expense, but actually I can profit while you profit, and we can make it easier for everyone else to profit in the process. Spontaneous cooperation is aligning around this common purpose of all or none. Once you see that your benefit is tied to everyone else's benefit, you are spontaneously cooperating with everyone. And that's a lot of what we do at the Buckminster Fuller Institute. We have Faith Flanagan here tonight, our operations director. And we just love convening people together around cooperation. So welcome. That's what we're doing here tonight. And the ecological offense piece is really, really important. And I think one that has not been paid much attention to in climate change, and we'll get into that. But it's about applying the regenerative principles of living systems. There's 3.8 billion years of research and development that biology and nature has been doing. They call it biomimicry, you know, looking to nature for design inspiration. And then finally, not to the disadvantage of anyone, we all need to act in a spirit of generosity. So I invite anyone else to take it as their mission. My husband and I actually used it as part of our vows. So I first read Fuller's books when I was at Presidio Graduate School in 2009, and I was immediately hooked. I had never found anything so deeply resonant. And for those of you who don't know, Fuller was a futurist. He was a philosopher, a scientist, an architect, and an author. He had this really great combination of being a techno-utopian while also being a humanitarian, while also being an ecologist. Some call that a polymath. And he was described as the Leonardo da Vinci of the 20th century. And something I learned recently was that Leonardo da Vinci's papers didn't get published for a while, and you know, took many years for the helicopter to be built. So I see kind of Buckminster Fuller just kind of lurking in the corners here, and we have so much to tap into from what he's taught us. One thing that he called himself was a trim tab. So this is within a system, kind of the nodal point where you can exert a small amount of pressure and achieve maximum benefit. So the trim tab is the small rudder on a larger rudder on a ship that moves first and causes that initial pressure differential that enables the larger rudder to move and then the larger ship to move afterwards. And it's something that we look for in Buckminster Fuller Institute of what kind of projects we want to support, what kind of investors that we want to work with are people who are looking at that trim tab kind of nodal or acupressure point within a system. So one of Fuller's most famous quotes that many of you have probably heard is that you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. So I think this is a really important inspiration for looking at climate change. We're really focused on the problem, and in doing so, we're kind of focused within that paradigm that created the problem, the kind of more reductionist, mechanistic, linear, industrial paradigm that created the problem. And we're looking, importantly, to the emissions, which is part of the system for sure, but that's like only looking at the exhale without looking at the inhale. So there's an incredible amount of inhaling that our ecosystem is doing every moment. And that's the stuff that really brings me to life. I get so excited about soil carbon. And we can geek out all you want later, and we'll get into it in just a little bit. One of our board members with Buckminster Fuller Institute, Tom Chi, has a really good new talk out called Helping Humanity Become a Net Positive to Nature. I recommend looking that up, where he goes through a lot of these different opportunities. So one thing I did as I was researching for Drawdown with Paul Hawken is I got really into carbon. And one thing I discovered is that carbon is the element that likes to hold hands and collaborate. Carbon really loves bonding. And it's really important that we stop demonizing it. We have to value it and bring it back to life. And there's a lot of ways that we can do that. And I think it's really important just for our own anxiety about this current time to fall back in love with carbon and fall back in love with ourselves and realize that we can be a beneficial species. Because in fact, for millennia, we have been. Humans had a huge part in planting the Amazon. We've been kind of this keystone species for millennia and millennia, and just in the last 1,000 years or so have been kind of in this slumber, but now are awakening from it. And you might ask, what does it mean to be a beneficial species? In fact, it's really rare not to be. Most species within an ecosystem are beneficial. It means essentially that you're creating more ecosystem services or ecosystem benefit than you are extracting or having ecosystem consumption. So, you know, there's a lot of people concerned about how much we're consuming, and, you know, we can consume that much if we're creating that much service in balance. So it's really about looking at a systems perspective. But it's really hard to do that if you don't have a lot of stories around what that means. So in 2014, I was talking with my friend Paul Hawken, and we were just talking about, you know, how are we ever going to get to the place where we need to go? And he also loves soil carbon, and we were kind of geeking out about it. And decided that we would write this book, Drawdown. And a big inspiration there is, in psychology, they call it the availability heuristic. But it's essentially like what you can imagine to be true is more likely to come true. So that which you are have available, like different examples in your mind, you're more likely to kind of walk the path towards that. So in 2014, we started Drawdown. And as Malcolm mentioned, we had students at Presidio do the initial research there. And yeah, we just really wanted to paint this picture of what was possible. You know, what does the future look like when we really focus on this? And unlike other integrated assessment models of its type, instead of saying, how are we going to get to 2050, you know, by with this amount of emissions, it's really just looking at what's happening now from a somewhat conservative point of view. So Drawdown found that in about 30 years ago, we can peak concentrations, not just emissions, but concentrations in our atmosphere of greenhouse gases and start to come down again. And that means about 20 years later, we can experience global cooling, which is how we got the title, the most comprehensive plan to reverse global warming. So it can happen in about 50 years. And again, our numbers were somewhat conservative because we wanted to ensure that people, you know, could really believe in the book and use it. So in the lifetime of many people in this room tonight, we can reverse global warming.
Yeah.
So this is one of the questions that came up as we were working on the book. Is climate change happening to you? And if so, you're the victim. It's very hard to feel creative or to think long term when you're a victim. Or is climate change happening for you? Again, how can we fall back in love with carbon? How can we move from that mechanistic, industrialized, reductionist paradigm over into a much more collaborative, ecosystem-inspired, living system paradigm? In this process. And I see it happening. I am, you know, thrilled to have a position where I'm seeing a lot of these projects come across my desk every day of people doing this around the world. And we'll get into those a little later. And it is just, it's just such a joy to be able to see it happening already. And I encourage everyone to kind of dive into these solutions that we're about to go into. So Drawdown looked at mapped, measured, and modeled 80 different strategies and did a 30-year forecast. And the results were really surprising. There's no silver bullet, which we kind of anticipated. It's more of a silver buckshot, as some people call it. And we found that food solutions, if you aggregate them, are actually more important than energy solutions. If you're looking at the CO2 equivalent, the number one solution was refrigeration, which is all about the really high potent greenhouse gases that we use for air conditioning and refrigeration and ensuring those don't go into the atmosphere. And we just found this whole tapestry of solutions and found that, you know, similar to the 100% of humanity, you know, everyone has a role in this. You don't, you know, it's not like everyone needs to go out and be a solar engineer, though that is very important. But we all have a role. So kind of, you know, choose the one that brings you to life and go for it. Drawdown was created by a huge coalition. We had 60 fellows from over 25 countries join us, a lot of whom had PhDs in their subject matter and were able to bring in research from around the world. And this is a visualization from NASA that we discovered as we were putting Drawdown together. And it's a year of CO2 emissions. And you see a couple of things happening here. You see that the Earth is connected and CO2 moves around. But you also see this incredible inhale that happens in the summer months in the Northern Hemisphere. And that's because there's more plant life there and photosynthesis occurs mostly in the summertime. And so every year, mini drawdowns are happening. And this is so important. This is kind of like a micro availability heuristic moment within creating this larger book of making it seem possible. And yeah, encourage everyone to take that as a little like Xanax whenever you're panicking about the future of the climate. So these are the seven sectors that we looked at. Again, food was the top sector if you added it up. We also looked at energy, land use, women and girls, materials, building and cities, and transportation. And if you add them all up, there's about 1,000 gigatons. A gigaton is a billion tons. There's 1,000 gigatons of reduction that we can do in the next 30 years and that we need to do. So that was what we've discovered at Drawdown. And then I moved from Drawdown 2 years ago to become executive director of Buckminster Fuller Institute. And we are bringing these solutions to scale. So we run a challenge program. The last 10 years, it's been called the Fuller Challenge. And we look for projects around the world that are multi-pronged, that solve multiple problems at once, and are these trim tab solutions. So one thing that we've found in all of these strategies is that people who are planning for indirect effects, so people who are thinking in systems and really understanding that any action, you know, you pull one thread and it touches everything else in the universe, people who are planning for that kind of indirect effect can ensure that the indirect effects become cascading benefits. And if you aren't planning for it, then you end up with a lot of unintended consequences. So it's two sides of one coin. And these people that we've awarded over the last 10 years are all taking this more systems, whole systems thinking approach and philosophy to their work. And it's been really rewarding to learn more about their projects and to continue to cultivate this community. So we'll get into four examples here. Ocean farming, regenerative agriculture, living buildings, and women and girls. So these are all four solutions that we researched at Drawdown, and then now at Buckminster Fuller Institute, we're scaling around the world. So ocean farming, it's in the coming attractions section of Project Drawdown. There's not as much data around it, so we couldn't map, measure, and model it, but it's really exciting. So seaweed is one of the fastest growing plants in the world. Some kelp can grow up to 12 feet long in just 3 months. And ocean farms, they don't require any fresh water. You don't have to conduct any deforestation. There's no fertilizer needed. And those kelp can absorb up to 5 times more carbon than any land-based plants. So much good news. Wait for this part. Okay, there's a species of red algae that, if you feed it to cows, can reduce their methane by up to 99%. Yeah, it's called A Cow Walks Onto a Beach in Drawdown. That's the name of that chapter. And yeah, it basically just kind of works in their digestive system to reduce the amount of methane that's coming out. It's still early research, and we need to farm it, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. But I love stuff like that. So Green Wave was the winner of the Buckminster Fuller Challenge in 2015. They do ocean farming. They combine kelp and shellfish and kind of do this 3D vertical farming in the water. And it creates more habitat for life. It deacidifies the ocean in that area. It creates a recreational zone for humans. And it creates all these cascading benefits. Because it's thinking in systems, it's kind of, you know, on that side of the coin of indirect effects. So it's these positive feedback loops of value creation, these cascading benefits, and they just kind of build on themselves. Regenerative agriculture is something I'm super passionate about. I used to work in biochar. I got my degree from Presidio and then kind of dove into biochar. It's a charcoal that, when added to the soil, boosts productivity, increases water retention, and sequesters carbon. It's pure carbon. And it's what they call geotherapy. So it's like geoengineering, where we need to kind of rebalance the amount of carbon and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But if you do it with ecosystems in mind, it can be geotherapy rather than geoengineering. So you're kind of giving therapy to these ecosystems that we've degraded with our industrial age. And what happens in regenerative agriculture, there's a lot of different solutions and drawdown that you can read about, is essentially this thing called the soil carbon pathway, where carbon comes down through photosynthesis, gets turned into sugars, and those sugars go through the roots into the fungal network that's in the soil and turn into carbon in a couple different forms while they're in the soil. And in the process, again, cascading benefits, we're creating a lot of healthier food, healthier soil, healthier people, ideally more just economies, and bringing carbon back to life. So the winner in 2010 from the Buckminster Fuller Institute was the Savory Institute. They, at the time, were just working in southern Africa to graze cattle in a way that mimics how cattle have co-evolved with grasslands. So cattle and other animals were used to kind of graze in these tighter clumps because there were more predators around, and they would only disturb soil, you know, once or twice a year. But in the process, they would actually benefit the soil by disturbing it. So between their hooves, kind of digging it up a little bit, and their manure fertilizing it, and that fertilizer attracting bugs and birds and other biodiversity, they actually kind of left a healthier ecosystem in their wake. And in some of the places where Savory International is working now, there's actually entire river systems that have been restored, and there's just an incredible amount of ecosystem benefit that can be created. And so Savory Institute now, they're working, they have 40 hubs around the world, and they have a land under management the size of Alabama and Mississippi combined. And they've grown dramatically over the last decade, and we're really proud to have been kind of one of their initial supporters at a time when it was really hard, and still is very hard, for people to think that cows can actually be beneficial to the environment. Obviously, industrial farming and the way that cows are industrially farmed is absolutely horrible, and a huge, huge factor in greenhouse gases, and I'm not advocating for those kinds of cows or those kind of practices. I love the cows that are in those practices. But if you're doing this rotational or regenerative grazing, it can really create entire ecosystems of health. And the buildings and cities sector is 54 gigatons reduced over the next 30 years. At Buckminster Fuller Institute, we awarded the Living Building Challenge. And they are a challenge program that looks at buildings as a living entity. So kind of like LEED, but the next generation up in terms of building certification. This looks at the whole ecosystem, looking at the health and the beauty, and how can a building, you know, create more ecosystem services for the area where it is. So create more energy than it is using and clean the water that it uses. You know, a lot of these buildings have cleaner water going out than they do coming in. And finally, looking at women and girls. So in Drawdown, we found that educating girls, family planning, and empowering women smallholder farmers add up to, drum roll please, 126.6 gigatons reduced in the next 30 years, which is, sounds like a lot. It's hard to know exactly what that means, but it's a tenth, over a tenth of what we need to do in the next 30 years. So it's the number one solution to climate change. And it's, you know, it was startling to us. We kind of like looked back at the science and the research and tried to figure out if we really had it right. And basically the main math there is that a smaller population, especially now that we're kind of extracting more consumption than we are giving benefit, leads to a healthier society and less greenhouse gases. And it's really, really important. So in the next, by 2100, everyone kind of assumes we're going to have 10 billion people. That's a stat that's thrown around a lot. And that's actually just the median projection. The low is 6 and the high is 16. And that's dependent on what we're doing in the next couple of years, really, on family planning and giving access to people. So a project that's working on this is Oasis. They're going to be outside after our talk. And they create safe spaces for girls in West Africa. Their spaces in Nigeria have already reached over 20,000 girls and has been proven to increase secondary school graduation rates by 20-fold and delaying girls' marriage by 2.5 years. Right now, they're over halfway to raising their goal to open a new center in Niger, and they have a matching grant. So if there's any philanthropists in the room of any size, they'll be outside afterwards. And if you're looking to take action on something really important, I encourage you to talk to them. And speaking of action, I'm often asked, well, what do I do? And this is a mnemonic that I came up with after I was also trained by Al Gore in the Climate Reality Project. You know, there's a lot of big, huge ecosystem, you know, economic, large-scale projects that we need to do, and it all starts with the individual as well. So SPINE is the acronym here, and it stands for Systems Literacy, Passion Project, Investment, News, and Employment. So in terms of systems literacy, what I've found after digging into climate change for over 12 years now is that by understanding systems, we will be far better off in actually creating solutions that create more solutions in their wake and not solutions that create more problems in their wake. So the way I like to do this is by studying the local and global ecosystems and the flows of those ecosystems. I encourage you to do the same. Passion project, choose a solution, maybe from drawdown, maybe from another, and choose one that really brings you to life and start a side hustle with that solution. And maybe it'll become your main thing. Maybe find a friend who can help you with it. But, you know, just choose something and go for it. The planet is in the ICU, basically. So on the investments, how are you voting with your dollars? Where does your money sleep at night? Unless you're banking with a bank that banks with your values, it's probably flying around the world being leveraged over and over again in the economy that you don't want. It's probably touching the tar sands and all sorts of different fossil fuel projects around the world. So highly encourage you to move all your money and change your spending habits. So you might think, oh, it's only 20 more, or it's, you know, a dollar more to buy this tomato that's organic. I can't afford that. But that dollar is going to then be paid to an organic farmer who's using, you know, organic suppliers, and it has this kind of multiplier effect into the economy that we do want. So keep that kind of systems perspective in mind. In terms of news, just saturate yourself in the media of the future that you choose, that you want to create, and then you can become part of the media these days with Twitter and with op-eds. And finally, employment. How can you support this planetary regeneration with the, on average, 80,000 hours that you spend in your career? What can you do with your current job, or what can you move over to? So I hope that's helpful. Happy to dig into any of it afterwards. And finally, action item is become a member of the Buckminster Fuller Institute. We're convening a lot of really great events here in the Bay Area and beyond, and would love your support. And last action item is we'll have Presidio, Pachamama, HIP Investor, and Oasis Initiative outside after this for a discussion, and would love for you all to be part of that. And I will just finish with the Buckminster Fuller quote, as I do. And he said that it is now highly feasible to take care of everybody on Earth at a higher standard of living than any have ever known. It no longer has to be you or me. Selfishness is unnecessary. War is obsolete. It is a matter of converting our high technology from weaponry to livingry. Thank you.
I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we're listening to Amanda Joy Ravenhill and Malcolm Water speaking about From Climate Reality to Project Drawdown. Is this happening to us or for us? We welcome your questions.
First off, thank you so much. My name is Chris Taylor, the co-founder of something called Lumen. We make regenerative hemp elixirs. Malcolm, thank you for the shout out to Texas, a tried and true Texan living here in California. Go Texas. We're making some progress there. So we're not all what the news says we are. And I've also never heard anyone else say that they have a true love for soil carbon. And that's, I'm not married. So it's probably not a good reason why not to be married. But anyway, definitely love a soil carbon. I jumped off the deep end. I went into business, quit medical school to pursue this regenerative farming stuff and doing it, building a brand. I'm curious. I was at the Bloomberg Sustainability Roundtable during the Climate Action Summit week. And in that conversation, everyone was talking about cutting emissions. There's 20 plus billion dollar companies in the room talking about cutting emissions. When I asked who was involved with soil, they all raised their hands. In some way or another, they're all involved with soil. Yet when I proposed regenerative agriculture, seemed to fall on deaf ears a little bit. And it's almost like it's too far of a step. Like, we already are having to cut emissions. That's a lot. So I'm curious, with these, you know, multinational billion dollar companies, how you see accelerating that process of talking about drawdown, not just cutting emissions. Obviously, with the carbon economy, there's a penalty to emitting. So I'm kind of curious how you see progressing this conversation about putting it back where it came from. And that's more on the optimistic side, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. there's so much there. Well, just a couple of stats first. So Natural Climate Solutions is one thing that it's called, is about 70% or so of the emissions reductions that we can do. And it has 3% of the funding philanthropy-wise. People just aren't quite aware, and people generally think climate and energy, you know, that comes together. And it's, I think, the natural, you know, first step of, like, you know, the must we do this first stage of acceptance around this stuff. And so we're naturally kind of looking to that. I'm trying to think of your actual question is, like, how do we encourage more people to
Where are the parts of the conversation that you feel people latch onto? Specifically, we talked about business being the driver of change, especially in a capitalistic society. Where have you found people latching onto that concept, as opposed to it just, oh, we'll worry about that down the line?
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to share?
So I'll make a personal observation. I kind of got this from the Amanda Spine thing when it talks about investment. And she spoke a little bit about this, but follow your own money. When this question of agriculture was brought to Al Gore's attention, he said, look, I'm a vegan, but I don't think I can get people to eat less meat. So he's punted on it. So you're not hearing it from him. You're hearing a lot about renewable energy. Right, so the renewal, the regenerative farming is just not part of the conversation. I'm more optimistic than that. I actually believe that we can change the way that people eat, but it's going to take us. You know, so I get back to we are the ones. If we want to continue to eat food that is going to destroy our planet, that's a choice. We need to make a choice to eat food that regenerates the planet, right? So Amanda made the point about organic, and I think that that's a really easy one because everything's labeled, so you can do that. We can all do that, but I think we all need to take a look at our eating habits. I became a vegan in the last year because for environmental reasons. I love meat, but it's the wrong thing. Every bite of beef I take, I'm destroying the planet. Put that in your head and think about that. So I think we can change what happens in the business world by the actions we take as consumers, because that's the fuel that makes business run, is what we do as consumers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. And just to note, if it's regenerative beef, there's a different story there. We can talk about that later.
Yeah.
And then one other thing is that a project that we're sponsoring at Buckminster Fuller Institute is called Regen Network, and they're changing the economics of agriculture by enabling farmers to be rewarded for increasing soil carbon and increasing pollinator habitat and water retention and some of these other ecosystem services. They're using the blockchain to create basically ecological data commons that people can cooperate with and create currencies and other smart contracts off of, but really the story there is they're changing the economics of agriculture because so many farmers are like almost in like indentured servitude to these larger ag companies. I mean, they get stuck and they're just, you know, the margins are really thin. So if we have other economics at play, then people can, you know, restore their ecosystems and get rewarded for it.
Thank you both so much. It was really illuminating. And there's been a report that's kind of been circling the news sites in the past few weeks about how there's 100 companies that are responsible for 71% of emissions. And I'm curious if you could contextualize that in like the drawdown recommendations or if that's relevant at all.
So I haven't read those reports. Is that resonating with you at all, Amanda?
I've read similar reports. I don't know if I've read that exact same one. But in terms of, you know, there's a lot of things that corporations can do. And like in terms of the trim tab opportunity, you know, like how can we focus in on the leaders of those companies to have transformational experiences so that they can kind of see the reality that we're seeing? And yeah, I think, you know, it's part of the reason I went to business school was because it's the language of the world, you know, business and economics and finance is the language of the world. And so if we're going to transform the world, we need to be speaking in these kinds of lexicons. And yeah, I'll look into it and we can talk about it.
Yeah, so I'll look at that as well, because I absolutely believe that a big piece of the solution is caused by what consumers are prepared to spend money on, because that's what drives business. So if there's 100 companies and they're thriving, it's our fault, right? We're the ones, period. So knowing who those 100 companies are and making sure that other people know who those, so if I can find that, that'll be in a, I'll make a slide. Here's the 100 companies, right? And think about it, because as consumers, we can change behavior. It happens all the time.
I had the chance just to look at the book a bit. It's an incredible story you're talking about. It. And I'm just concerned the validity of some of these numbers. Mm-hmm. And did you have actually a expert technical team working with you? Obviously, as someone who wrote wind power utilization in Eastern Canada in 1970, the wind power issue of 40 times is music in my ear. So I just want to elaborate the technical team that was working with you behind this. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible story. Yeah. And one more issue, district heating is really an important issue. How did you come up with that number? It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. I can put you in touch with the people who can answer those specifically, but yes, you can be confident in the technical team that came together around this book. As I said, there was a large fellowship program, and then we also had partners like the Rocky Mountain Institute and others kind of check our numbers. And yeah, happy to kind of go into it with you further. But as I said before, we were actually on the conservative side, if anything, because we knew that they would be looked at very closely.
At this point in the program, we have reached the point where there's only time for one more question.
I really love that quote that you entered with the matter of converting weaponry to livingry and this idea of getting this global context around it. But how do you marry that with a world where we have these peer nations that don't want the best for us and that we set everything up in a rival state? You know, and it is very much a zero-sum world in a lot of other decision-making. Every technology that Russia or China or Iran might pull ahead of us is something that we lose, is something that in this sort of real politic is something that threatens our existence. So how do you, kind of when that war push comes to shove and safety is threatened, how do you marry that with like doing things as a united globe?
So I'll comment on one thing, and then Amanda, you can add to this. So in addition to in 2015, the entire world coming together and saying we're going to do this Paris Agreement, right? So there's nothing quite like people partnering together to say that maybe we shouldn't be shooting at each other while we're doing this. The other thing that happened at the same time was the world came together and signed on to the Sustainable Development Goals, the UN, right? So these 17 goals. And one of those is peace. We need to have peace, right? So without peace, we create these disruptions that sets everything back, whether it's climate change or equal justice. Everything goes back whenever we don't have peace. So In both cases, it was universal. It was the entire, all the countries in the world saying this. So at some point, we have to believe we're going to begin to act that way, that we have this one planet we call Earth, and we're going to take care of it. We just have to, and I actually believe that when we start to see the positive impacts of this, then it's going to take off, you know, and we're all just, this is great. Mm-hmm. That's the optimist in me.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, within complex systems, there's things called phase changes, and I think that's what we're in the midst of right now. So it's really hard to predict and see what's going to happen because it's like a kind of like a huge step change. You know, moving from a zero-sum game to a non-zero-sum game world, you still have to win the, like, last non-zero-sum game in those game dynamics in order to move over to the next game dynamics. I like to call these times the awkward era because there's, like, better news every day and also worse news every day for a while, for probably another couple, 4 decades, there's going to be increasing extreme weather. And if we're not nice to each other and if we don't have that emotional intelligence, like, you know, it's the conflict that I'm really scared about, the conflict that results from these extreme weather events. And we're already seeing it with Syria and the Arab Spring was tied to a drought in Russia. And, you know, there's already, we're in the midst of it. And I'll just end with another Buckminster Fuller quote. So he talked about how humanity now is like a chick, speaking of a phase change, just hatching from its eggshell. And that fossil fuels has actually been our yolk or our embryonic fluid to teach us everything that we need to know to live in a more cyclical existence. And just like a chick, it's not even aware of how capable it is, but it's been spending this last phase kind of getting ready for this next birth. And we're about to, you know, kind of crack open and discover that we have all of these tools. We're far more capable than we knew, that we built all the right tools for all the wrong reasons first. And it's time to get up and realize that we have wings and fly.
Thank you.
Again, I want to thank Amanda Ravenhill and Malcolm Walter for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here at the club, as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.
All right. Thank you.
We have a special treat tonight. We have a special treat tonight. I wanted to let all of you know, in addition to some superb organic wine being sponsored by Presidio Graduate School and Fetzer Vineyard, we have opportunities for you to explore these organizations that we've mentioned and actions. You could take actions that might bring further progress, including HIP Investor, measuring the ESG in your portfolio, talking to Pachamama about a course in drawdown, becoming a sustainability expert through Presidio Graduate School, supporting women and girls' education at Oasis, and, of course, drinking organic wine while thinking of carbon sequestration in soil. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.